Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
This is probably the eighth installment of Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen, the epic story of the star that gives us life. It's so far been very, very good. This is an excellent, excellent chapter. The only thing missing I can see is a sort of deeper reading of some of the key philosophers, the Greek philosophers, particularly Parmenides. And so if you really read deeply into these people, you realise that there's not a discontinuity between the Babylonian mythology and the Greek mythology, which comes along. But that being said, there's a lot of new information here that I simply didn't know, simply about the exploits of Thales. I only knew of him sort of sporadically, and the actual complexity and structure of the Greek schools. So, in fact, three Greek schools, the Academy with Plato meaning broad-shouldered wrestler, the Lyceum of Archimedes, which is more like a technical school, which broke off from the sort of university, and then a sort of a legal finishing school of rhetoric. So there were actually three different schools going on, and I think majority of people don't understand the distinction of it. One can see development of astrology and astronomy side by side. And similarly, we have a similar thing today. Our modern astrology would have to be Star Wars, Voltron, Hitchhiker's Guide, anything which has a bit of astronomy in, but a lot of culture labelled in on top of it. The astronomy takes second seat as a background, as a backdrop to other social affairs, and that often happens with many things in life, where the actual technical side of things is subsumed in our social organisation. So the politics is really important, but the industry is what actually produces stuff for us. But we tend to really get caught up with politics, and we celebrate politicians and public figures, but the actual people doing the vast majority of the heavy lifting in our society are the industrial workers, the scientists and stuff like that. So there's similar complexity going forward, which you go and see through here. So I'm going to read this, fortunately, to you. And Sophocles, he's a Greek philosopher in there. I don't know how exactly he fits in. I do know sort of the Socrates, Plato lineage, and sort of the Pythagoras lineage, Pythagoras, Parmenides lineage, down through Socrates, but I don't quite understand how Sophocles goes in. The Sophocles from 496 to 406 BC, so that's 90 years going backwards, obviously, in BC. And his quote is this: astronomy, impossible to understand and madness to investigate, which is essentially what you are. Ultimately, astronomy is the science really starts out as an exercise in lateral thinking, and which then sparks questions and then leads you down different paths. This is by Bernard. The next quote is Bernard Nightingale, the little literary Byron lover in Tom Stoppard's Arcadia. So Bertrand Nightingale is a fictional character, obviously, and he fictionally likes a real Byron, but he's in Tom Stoppard's book. And he says, don't confuse progress with perfectibility. A great poet, always timely, a great philosopher, is an urgent need. There's no rush for Isaac Newton. We were quite happy with Aristotle's cosmos. Personally, I prefer it. 55 crystal spheres geared to God's crankshaft is my idea of a satisfying universe. which goes, is a fundamental tension here in that we admit science first as a backdrop to our society, and then we allow it. It's very much second fiddle, and the progress is pretty hard since then. Okay, reading this book. The earliest references to astronomy amongst the Greeks appears around 800 BC in the poems of Homer and Hesiod. By that time, their countrymen, like the Babylonians and the Egyptians, had put their names to various stars and quantified the rising and settings of the sun. However, they were not content with merely recording the movements of the heavens. Once they took to astronomy in earnest, they inquired into what the skies were made of, the shapes and sizes of the sun, the stars, the planets, the earth itself, how far these were from one another, and what revolved around what, in orbits of what form, the number of stars, whether they could be located with systematic accuracy. To do this, they added a raft of further questions about the immediate worlds. Exactly how long was a year or a month? When were the equinoxes, and could one pinpoint the exact moment of the solstice? The one matter on which most agreed is that the Earth itself is stationary and the central, a belief that would bedevil science for millennia. Okay, this is not exactly true, because we know the Egyptians really wanted to nail down the solstice for various points in times. But it is true that they had begun to ask the next question of, rather than descriptive, but what does it mean? So that's probably a step beyond. If you have a society which is purely with declarative knowledge, that is, I declare this Monday, I declare this Tuesday, I declare this star here, I declare this happens, and then you only have to explain why, was that someone else is making a decision for you, that a god has declared it. So the Greeks have gone a step further. Despite the crucial misapprehension, a formidable line of Greek students of the stars extends over them over 1,000 years. From the time of Hesiod until at least the deaths of Ptolemy. Ptolemy spelt P-T-O-L-E-M-Y. It took me a while to pronounce that properly. The muster of ancient Chinese philosophers may have stretched twice as far, but the Greek roll call is more impressive. I don't know why you say that one. The great German scholar Otto Nuremberger lists 121 astronomers of note, and even that tally excludes figures such as Pheraclides of Cyrus, the watcher, the teacher of Pythagoras, Zeno of Ella, so Zeno's paradox, he was a doubter. He sort of Plato, obviously, but Plato tended to describe it, and Epicurus. So Epicurus was a fantastic Greek philosopher. So you get to know them, but you know, I've only got cursory knowledge. I know that our understanding of Greek, of Epicurus, is incorrect, in that we talk about Epicurus, this is fine foods and fine things like that. He was thinking of more a not feasting, but ensuring everything that you ate was a feast. Does that sort of make sense? And I have that philosophy. I've often get told off for really enjoying simple takeaway meals, enjoying very simple things of fruit and stuff like that. You have to spend a lot of money for it. So Epicurus is associated with high cuisine, whereas he himself was just a fairly simple person. And it's also interesting in that his viewpoint is an area of philosophy which led to biology. The cell theory, Epicurus, and went into the Greek, into the German belief a lot more. Okay, many familiar names appear. Aristotle, Euclid, Archimedes, Ptolemy, and others were giants in their time, but less well known now. such as Parmenides. Parmenides is just absolutely critical because he basically wrote a single poem about a visit to the sun god, so, and talked about night and day, and sparked off philosophy as we know it. You have to go there. There's Anaxagoras, Eudoxus, Hereticus, and Aristocrus. I can't pronounce them too well. All these people I know, but we will get to know them a lot more by reading it. Of course, they built in part on the foundations laid by the Babylonians. You're not joking, particularly Parmenides. Herodicus, 484 to 425, in his only book, The Inquiries, more transliterated as the Histories, describes how his countrymen not only copied the Babylonian records and calculations, but also borrowed several of their measuring devices, such as that for the reckoning of the motion of the sun along the ecliptic. Okay, so the ecliptic is the region where the sun and the moon tend to, and the other planets orbit. And in that plane, therefore, that plane defines where the eclipse is going to be. That's what's called the ecliptic. And the first glimpses of an astronomy that went beyond pure observation came from the Egyptians. Okay, so you can see, so Herodicus is a sort of a historian. Historiography. I can't pronounce that properly. In the early days of Greek astronomy, however, its practitioners did not even seem to consider the predictions of heavenly phenomena particularly valuable. In the Dialogues of Pheraedus, Plato blames his countrymen for not being interested enough in planets. Indeed, astronomy did take some time to put down roots into Greek culture. So, Plato, you have to understand there's no journals at this time, there's no publishing houses. People, if they have to write something, and it's complex, a complex thing, and there's no academics to write to, you have to write basically a play for the general public, but put his ideas in terms of a plan. So Plato wrote play scripts where his characters would come to life and have conversations and say things. This mindset changed after the Greeks came into contact with the observation tablets of the Babylonians during the creation of the Macedonian Greek Empire under Alexander, who dispatched literally camel loads of Babylonian astronomical tablets to the Greek cities along the Adriatic coast. So the Babylonians had really the first writing system, and the writing system was simple. You have soft clay, which is nanoparticles. So clay refers to particularly the size of the particles. When the particles are sufficiently small, they have sufficient moisture content to form a sort of a gel. So sort of a semi-fluid thing which you can press with a stick, an edge, and by putting the edges in a particular way you can make tablets. And they had a number system, and they had basic stone tablets, so it looked really like the equivalent of a USB stick back then. And so Alexander the Great basically conquered the Persians, the Babylonians. And so Persia by far was the more superior scientific culture to the Greeks, but they sort of became, despotic, sort of a breakup between the science and the actual rulers. Okay, so, but it's interesting that the Greeks had sort of a science separate from the ruling class, whereas the Chinese and Babylonians, the scientists sort of made a way of their life very central to the rulers. The rulers needed them. We'll read that a bit later on. By around 650 BC, the old aristocratic order have been overthrown, supplanted by a succession of tyrants, then meaning rulers who seize absolute authority, not necessarily cruel despots, who encourage trade and economic reform. So for the first time, there was an opportunity throughout the Greek states for a different style of life. Okay, so by getting rid of kings and having people who just strong men, the strong men had to be better than kings, basically, and so they had to just garner support. You know, the politics evolved, and because there was not an interplay of kings, where you just had the king of this, the king of that, and you sort of, they kept a separate meta society, of the royal society between royals. This is sort of like the industrialists took over, and this led to sort of similar to an America. But we believe in America, like the Europe was the old order, America's the new order, the new frontier, and you had these tyrants. We would probably say that Elon Musk and Steve Jobs would be tyrants in a certain way, and they are in ways, but not tyrants as we meant by tyrants. Enjoying means to reflect rather than having solely concern with survival. This is a major thing, that there was some Greek technology, but the actual stable enslavement of slaves meant that you could work. If you had two or three human beings you were on top of, and the society, it was basically slave society. It was often, from this point, to quote the great scholar of the period, D.R. Dix, quote, "The Greeks' passion for rational investigation along mathematical lines converted a mass of crude observational material into an exact science." So, indeed, the observation industry of the Babylonians came up, but the Greeks had something else going on. And you've got to see that there just wasn't successful enterprise. There was markets going on, market systems, trading. There was a market system going on because they were not next to each other. There were ships that came across, and they would want things, and so it would sort of formalize trade into blocks. So if you were sort of next to each other, you wanted something, you eventually get pissed off and invade them. But to invade another colony, which is a sea journey away, you could see them coming over the horizon. And sort of trade is a bit different around the Mediterranean. This is just my observation. The first great practitioner was Thales, 625 to 647. So this is after Herodotus, this is before Herodicus. So Herodicus was 484, so this is 200 years earlier. In Miletus, a prosperous port serving the whole of the Aegean. A nobleman by birth, he was also a statesman, an engineer, a merchant. Canny enough, the story goes, quietly corner the olive presses of Miletus and neighbouring Chios, just ahead of what he knew would be a bumper harvest, thereby amassing considerable fortune, proof that he was a philosopher who could make money if they chose. And this is sort of Aristotle, and as you understand, Aristotle trying to distinguish himself, his Lyceum from the Academy. So he had basically Lyce at the moment is school, okay, so he had some more a practical school for people, and part of his thing is saying, well, study philosophy but you'll make money. So you can sort of see how this idea came across, and I did make a big mention that he was Aristotle did support this person, the Chinese got onto this podcast, in which I just basically said this about Aristotle, and left it. But there was a little bit more to it as I read a bit more. It's that Aristotle sort of had a commercial aspect to what he said, a commercial, practical, pragmatic side. Tales had travelled to Egypt to learn elementary principles of practical geometry. So geometry basically is, geo means earth, measuring, and they had to measure the earth because the floods covered up, the floods of the Nile. A lesson that would inspire him to make astronomy a deductive science. So basically he learned to measure the earth, and then, let's look what we can do with the heavens. It was the first deposit that the moon eclipses the sun when it moves in direct line between it and the earth, and first Greek to maintain that it shone by reflected sunlight. So there you go, it's amazing. So I didn't know this, and this is where this book is so fantastic. Giving you ideas. He is said to have established the times and sequences of equinox. He is amply quoted in Petrarch, Pliny, Cicero, Diogenes, Lateris, with its fortunate, which is fortunate, as none of his writings survive. Indeed, both ancient and modern scholars have built him up into a scientific hero on the very thin evidence, and I would exactly say that, and I think those later people had thin evidence, and it's sort of like we basically, if you had to list everything, the thin evidence, the real knowledge of what was going on, say, in the golden age of the early 20th century in science, say, everyone has a few figures, and if you say Einstein, people stop listening, they go, oh, well, I don't have to pay attention, I don't have to question it. And so similar here, tales maybe in this area. According to Diogenes, BC 412, which is a good 100 years after him, tales is the first to gauge the sun's diameter in relation to the apparent orbit around the earth with any accuracy, estimating it to be 1/720th thereof, a ratio exceptionally close to the estimate of Earth's actual orbit around the sun. So I don't know exactly what that means. So the diameter, which is, that's bizarre. The diameter into the orbit. So the sun's diameter is 1.3 million, and we're 150 million. So that's 170 is not too accurate. Less impressively, he argued that water was the prime element of the universe, which you would see. Well, the water, the sun looks like a liquid droplet, quite honestly. He was on firmer ground when postulating that the duration of the sun's circuit between solstices was never even, and that the solar year lasted 365 days. But again, we know too little about his writings to be certain of what he actually said. Ironically, he is best remembered for something he never did predict, the solar eclipse of the 20th of May, 585 BC, and there's a sign. Now, Plato adds a less dignified anecdote of the astronomer, in his youth, so caught up with his stargazing that on one occasion he tripped and fell down a well, to be promptly teased by, quote, a clever, pretty maidservant from Thrace, who asked, "How do you expect to understand what's going up in the skies when you don't even see what's in your feet?" The first absent-minded Professor Joe. So what she called a maid servant, so a female servant, which would probably be a female slave, which is interesting, but that gives you the quality that there wasn't printed records, there was no internet and stuff like that, and Plato, in making these things up, would have to write an interesting story. So he wouldn't be able to, if you write a statement in Greece, that wouldn't really hang anywhere. It had to be part of a story. And so like his dialogues were story. Everything was in the form of a story and had a plot to it. It was sort of like a mini series. Like everything was an up and coming mini series, which is sort of interesting if you read the Principalia, some of the early works. There's the idea. There's no idea of a scientific work that came much later. One giant of this time was Heraclitus. 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 535 to 475 BC. So he's a bit after. A mystic poet who rejoiced in the nickname of "He Who Rails at the People" for his arrogant misanthropy. Okay, so you also have to remember that Parmenides was a poet, and this is what exactly every poet was. Poems and ballads were the TV programs. So these people are sort of like people. Like we would know Carl Sagan and a few people like that. The 130 fragments of his writings that survived emphasize two aspects of the cosmic order: the continuity and periodicity, especially that of the sun. Aspects of his thinking can still be seen in the writings of Darwin, Spencer, and Masters in the 19th century. Okay, so this is Parmenides. I think left something like 800 fragments, and the people have different fragments that they're trying to actually put together. Okay, yeah, different fragments they're trying to put together for him. So that's of interest. And indeed, the fragments people have said, "Oh no, you've got to put this fragment here." They've reordered it and realised that people have made mistakes putting these fragments together, and have used reviews, book reviews. So, imagine you had a whole heap of book reviews of Jane Austen and the book and the mini series, and then what went is the actual books disappeared and everyone had to reconstruct it. Okay, and then people would say, "Well, no, it didn't start off with the Pemberley, it worked out there." He could be absurdly wrong. For instance, he suggests that the sun is just a foot across, about the size of a shield, and there was a new sun every day. But his belief, this is poetic, it's sort of like Shakespeare, "I compare thee to a summer's day," and such a type of stuff. But his belief in the universe is composed of worlds that are being created and destroyed in a continuous cycle would have a modern physicist nodding in agreement. He understood that nothing is constant. Hence the dictum, "One cannot step twice in the same river." So that's his same view. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that absolutely beautiful? Or if you can, that is the concept. You're stepping in the concept. Another in the line of a Greek mathematician, astronomers, was Pythagoras of Samos. Now, he is something I could speak for an hour on. Who flourished during the second half of the 6th century BC. Okay. So, this is probably contemporary with him. He is said to have spent 22 years travelling Arabia, Syria, Chaldea, Phoenicia, Greek, Gaul, better known today as French Riviera, and possibly India, before settling in southern Italy when over 50 years old. So the basic thing is that, yeah, he did fall in love with maths and try to teach maths, and basically he would pay people to listen to him, and as soon as the money ran out, they ran away. So he's a bit upset. He spent more time in Egypt, studying astronomy, geometry, and, as a popular historian, Will Durant, puts it, perhaps a little nonsense. An astronomer of exceptional originality, once in Italy, so he's in Sicily, basically, he discovered mysterious properties of specific numbers, including number one and the monads. And it's interesting. So this is just really a light reading of him. But it takes so much to... I might reread Pythagoras. And, of course, Pythagoras' theorem is basically Babylonian. Okay, so... he created a new word to cover such inquiries, which translate love of wisdom in Greek, philosophy. In the 6th century, philosopher, and Pythagoras was Cinnamon's. So Pythagoras was the school of philosophers. Pythagoras saw number as the essence of all things, the monads, obviously, and which goes up to Leibniz. Harmony as the most beautiful, and the universe is fundamentally well organized. He pioneered the science of acoustics, which enabled him, which he extended to hypothetical harmony of the spheres, believing that as with strings on an instrument, each orbiting planet sounded its characteristic note, its pitch determined by its size and speed. The five planets then known, together with the Sun, the Moon, and the Earth, are formed an octave. And no one seemed worried the fact that the Earth believed in the stationary would therefore not be vibrating. But it's interesting that the harmony of spheres actually goes with the vibrations, is quantum particles in my view, my reading of it, but no one would listen to me ever. Okay. He also believed that those bodies of the sky moved in two separate circular motions, so that the Sun circled the Earth every 24 hours in one revolution, but also made a second journey around the Earth along a different circle, at an angle to the first, once every year. He was attempting to rationalize. This is obviously bizarre. You couldn't understand that one, could it? He was attempting to rationalize the apparent motion of the stars in the universe, he deemed geometric, and his theory broke down when he applied it to planets. But this was the first serious attempt to explain their motion. All modern science stems from Pythagoras' cause insight that there are patterns in nature, and that those patterns can be described mathematically, which is really rather interesting for Pythagoras. Damn. Let's see if I can get this microphone up a bit better. Yeah, so that's interesting. I hope this improves the listening to it. I had one end of the microphone. You'd hear rather differently there. This is interesting, but Pythagoras saw patterns in nature, and that's a very first thing. And if I can go back to my sciences, a preamble, a pattern, a path to that pattern, to seeing that pattern, then a picture of the pattern, and then the significance. Is it numerically significant? Is it evidentially significant? What does the evidence signify? And is it socially significant? And then you have, this is basically hypothesis, but written in more general terms to capture all of science. Sure, I had a different significance, but it's evidential significance and sort of knowledge significance. Does it add to what we know? How does it add? And then you have what I say in terms of science of multiple choice, that is to fit your world into the structure of existing knowledge. Answers, and then further questions from those answers to go forward. Okay, Pythagoras quickly passed into myth. And myth, I mean, Greeks would say that he had a golden thigh, that his thigh leg was made out of gold. Okay, and he was truly whack. And legend about him were already circulating in Aristotle's time. He had many followers, several of whom advanced our knowledge of the Sun. We know that one of them, Parmenides, worked That the bright side of the moon shone because it turned towards the sun. It was also first pronounced that the earth was spherical. Well, you have to be pretty, well, he's got some poems. I don't know whether that actually was in the poems. His poem goes that I was sitting down and this sort of limo of sun goddesses came up on their powerful steeds and took me up into the chariots, into the sky, that type of stuff. And I don't think you'd be really searching for too much science in it all. Once the idea had established itself, Pythagoreans went on to reason that heaven too must be spherical. And so spherical coordinates made their appearance. Philardus, from 470 to 385 BC, a bit later on, a contemporary of Socrates, even preempted Copernicus by moving the Earth to the centre of the cosmos, making it a planet. However, in his system, the Earth still did not orbit the Sun, but rather circled an unseen central fire. All else was spread out across space, including the Sun, which was not a body with its own light, but a reflector of the central fire. The universe centered on the fire because this was the noblest of the elements, and the center, the most honorable place, a theory adopted almost by most of the leading schools in Athens. So that's an interesting thing, that the sun was a reflected light. Some of the finest solar astronomers, however, came from outside Athens. So this is interesting. These were the three annexes: Anaximander, Anaximenes, and Anaxagoras, who, like Thales, all hailed from Miletus. So I have to work out where that is. As indicated by the prefix Anax, which means Lord, each was sort of like Darth Vader. Each was well-born. Aximander's pupil was Aximenes, who taught some 30 years before Anaxagoras, the greater of the three. So you had two and then a gap. Aximander was already 64 when, in 650 BC, he wrote one of his first works on natural philosophy. He may also, following the Egyptians, have introduced the Gnomon. So it's G-N-O-M-O-N. And appears to have marked his down in some forms of the motion of the planets, the angle of the ecliptics, and the dates of the solstice, equinoxes, seasons. He engraved the first world map into the tablet of brass, and with his geometric model of the Earth, Sun, and Moon, stars sought to depict the heavens in a non-mythological term. So that's a major, major cosmic engine things. Anaximenes, 528, was less original, but is best known for his doctrine that the air is the source of all things, which is in contrast to Thales' view that everything comes from water, and we have the fire behind. although the element in his time, he had little to say about the sun. Only that it didn't travel under the earth, but circled around it, hidden by high mountains at night, in sharp contrast to the third member of his group, Anaxagoras. So it didn't travel underneath the earth, it's travel around him. Although his name is translated as Lord of the Marketplace, his parents evidently hoped he would turn into a merchant prince. When Anaxagoras moved to Athens from Miletus, at the age of 20, he gave away his inheritance in order to devote himself to the study of the skies. Sounds all right, sort of one of these rich kids. One of his earliest pupils, later his close friends, was Pericles. So Pericles is one of these fantastic Greek people. He's well known, but what did he do? He just was in that golden age of Greece. who grew up becoming the most influential person in Athens, at the heart of Greece's golden age. This period began after the Greeks had repulsed the Persians in 497 BC and endured to 399 BC. So that's 80 years of golden age, which is no longer than, like, is the US golden age of 80 years, I suppose. During this time, Athens became the most famous, evolving under the guidance of Pericles into a great intellectual centre of the Mediterranean world, a place where the work of Anaxagoras and his fellow astronomers could flourish. This is interesting that what I'm reading here has no currency. Like, today, if I talk about ancient Greeks, they would just say, get stuffed. Star watchers of the era had only the most primitive technology to help them, and even their observatories were probably no more than flat-roofed buildings. What they did have was mathematical geometry. Even then, closely allied with astronomy, and the same men were usually active in both fields. Yet solar astronomy continued to be a mix of the utterly wrong, as would be come to be seen, and the formidably acute. For the instance of the latter, Onopides of Chiros not only came up with the idea of the ecliptic, but went on, to measure the angle of the Earth's against the ecliptic plane and figured it out to be 23.45 degrees, less than 3/10 of a degree of the present accepted value. And that's, I wonder what 3/10 means, because it's a 60th degree. Among his many accomplishments, I believe he's got that wrong, if I put it in. 27. Yeah, I don't know. I think he's got this wrong. I think he hasn't converted the difference in minutes into degrees, which is a slight difference because you only got 16 minutes and 100th. So, 3/10. No, that doesn't make sense. Among his many accomplishments, Anaxagoras has even been able to explain lunar eclipses, but his insight was not taken up. He was far too ahead of his time. Around 440 BC, a meteorite over the foot of the diameter fell on Thrace in a broad daylight. Anaxagoras, visiting and seeing it on display, concluded that it had fallen from the sun, which must, he reckoned, be a mass of red-hot iron. Thus, heavenly bodies were not divine beings, but material objects. The authorities charged him with atheism, and he retired in exile to Lampicus, where he died, much honoured by his new neighbours in 428 BC. So there goes you for most, and that's true for almost all academics. In 432 BC, Menton of Athens, a leading geometer, an engineer, had made a detailed study of the summer solstice, probably employing a gammon-like device known as a heliotropion, or sun term, a pillar fixed upon a level platform which enabled him to measure the ratio of the noon shadow. He also constructed a parapegma, a simple engraved list of astronomical events, and merged the traditional agricultural calendar with into one for the city use. He became famous, indeed, a celebrity of sorts, for his enthusiasm for geometric astronomy, which he found himself publicly held up to ridicule in Astrophanes, the comedy, the birds. Because it's a comedy and a play, it kept on going, sort of like we know about French history from Les Miserables, that top grade of knowledge. So here's a quote. So it's Pythagoras. In the name of the gods, who are you? Menton. Who am I? Menton, known throughout Greece and Colonus, What are these things? Which obviously is a play. Tools for measuring the air. In truth, the spaces in the air have precisely the form of a furnace. With this bent ruler, I draw a line from the top to the bottom. From this point, I describe a circle with a compass. Do you not understand? Not the least. With a straight ruler, I set to work to inscribe a square within a circle. In its centre will be the marketplace into which all straight lines will lead, converging in the centre like a star, which, although not orbicular, sends forth its rays on a straight line from all sides. Whatever the heck does that mean? So, can you imagine, dude, what a horrible play. Okay. So, so this is sort of like Jimmy Carson getting a view. So we've got little snippets of Greek TV coming through to us, and it's really complex. The same summer that Minton was making his solstice calculations, Athens became embroiled in a struggle against a coalition by its arch rival Sparta, a conflict that endured with one brief interlude for 27 years. When it finally wore itself out, the political structure of the tyrant city was in ruins. A plague that lasted for 3 years had killed over a third of its population. In the turmoil around 428 BC, a great figure was born. His name was Aristocles, best and renowned. But his prowess as a wrestler in the Isthmian Games, so the Isthmuses are down, Athens up the top, and the Isthmian Games are down, led to his name as Platon, the Broad. Unlike his father, like the fathers of Pythagoras and Socrates, the one merchant seaman and another a stonemason, both Plato's parents were wealthy, each coming from the most ancient aristocratic families in Greece. So you can see my stroke things, my brain things, trying to get the pronunciation right. So this is interesting, because now we know that Plato is fat man, the fat man. Athens was a state of only 250,000 people, half citizens and their families, the rest slaves and resident foreigners, its capital numbering about 75,000 people. So Athens was a region, and the actual state was pretty small, and so that's the size of, I don't know, Goulburn, sort of, not a major city. The city was never more than a narrow margin away from serious hunger and devoid of almost any medical services. So this is after Pericles. Pericles is, I don't know what year, this is 428, and Pericles is, oh, right, 428. There's Eastern Golden Age, because the Golden Age ends at 400. Okay, well, he's talking and the tyrants have gone, okay. A place where even people who owned other human beings had a standard of living greatly below the working class of modern industrial democracies. The term burglar and world piercer, because the houses were so fragile. Yeah, you're going to say there's a whole series of problems. I think they estimate that the average person with power, electric power, has the equivalent of living a life of 50 slaves. So you can imagine what it's like. Having survived his home city's crushing defeat and brutal oligarchic revolution of 404 BC, a confused restoration of democracy, then a trial and the death of Socrates in 399 BC. So 399 BC, Socrates is the end of the Golden Age. Plato fled to Megara, a trading port some 26 miles to the northeast, thence to Egypt. Out of various adventures at one point sold into slavery, although quickly ransomed by 395 BC. This is really happening quickly. He returned to his home city. 90 years later, following further travels to Italy and Sicily, he borrowed money from friends to purchase a patch of land on the outskirts of Athens, named after the local hero Academus. So Academus was a local hero because he got the Spartans away, okay, by saying Helen is hiding in a village, and the Spartans went away and got him. So they said, Academus, here's your land. So this is interesting because my belief was that legend, I thought, it was just, this Plato really did start things off. But it would be interesting why the land was, why the land would be suited for him. He would make his academy, where he was to teach for 40 years. Little could he have imagined that it would remain the intellectual center of Greece for the next 500 years. Plato made astronomy a branch of applied mathematics at his academy. The inscription over the doorway, according to legend, reading that no one enter here who is ignorant of geometry. No record exists of the Greeks using algebra before the time of Christ. Well, I don't think algebra existed, of course. Astronomy, which Plato sometimes called spheric, occupies a comparatively small place in his writings, except for his dialogue with Epinimos, which describes the work of an astronomer. So, but Plato was actually a playwright. It's pretty amazing. He would write plays. He didn't write books. Having embraced the concept of a spherical earth, stationary at the center of the spherical universe, he encouraged his students to investigate this system more carefully. But this soon raised some potentially disturbing questions. Plato believed stars and planets to be visible images of immortal deities whose movements were in part transcendent order. So this actually caused the problems because the Christians said that, and then they said, well, the number of angels equals the number of stars. The number of stars, visible stars, is 5,000. And then when they went to the Bible, they got more than 5,000, so there was a conflict in the Middle Ages. However, some celestial bodies did not move with the same regularity as the rest, but wandered, the Greek word for planet. Planetus originally meant wanderer. How to explain these motions within the context of his belief in the transcendental order? Here we go. For Plato, the task of the philosopher was to comprehend the reality underlying creation. If direct observation conflicted with the understanding of reality, he cautioned that things were not necessarily what they seem, a valuable enough axiom in the scientific study generally, but a douche of cold water for the would-be astronomers in the academy. But Plato's pupils were not put off, because even though they were never he never understood discipline, his academy made their deliberations possible. He died in 347 BC. Okay, an old man. One of his students erected an altar to him and gave him a funeral almost befitting a god. The student's name was Aristotle. He didn't even like Plato very much. Okay, well, I'm going to stop reading here and get back. And there's a good, I don't know, seven or so pages to go. But I'll put this in as an episode. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.